This is Neil Rockine. Welcome to another edition of Killer Cross-Examination, the podcast where we talk to some of the top trial lawyers in the country about their practices, their habits, their styles, their approaches. This week's episode is no different. With me is Mark Eiglarsh. I have to say, I'm just so honored to have you here, Mark. You certainly have earned your place among the great trial lawyers in the United States. Welcome to the Killer Cross-Examination podcast.
I appreciate it, Neil. Thank you for saying that. And it's a pleasure to be with you.
So I have to give sort of the obligatory kind of tell me about your background, but I'm so excited to actually talk to you about the Scott Peterson case that I want to get to that. But I think it would be a disservice for us to not at least set the table a little bit for how you ended up doing trial work and criminal defense work, because you're obviously so good at it.
I appreciate it. So I started as a prosecutor 30 plus years ago. Janet Reno gave me my first job as a Miami prosecutor. I then went to the dark side, as they say, about 3.5 years after that. And I've stayed there ever since. I love doing what I'm doing. I do primarily state and federal criminal defense. I'll do some personal injury and wrongful death matters occasionally, but really my lane is criminal cases.
Mark, you've obviously developed a following in court, in the media. You're well known for not just trial work, obviously, but have done many media appearances. Kind of tell me how you got into that, and then that'll lead us right into how you've become such a successful trial lawyer.
So my major was radio and television production. I always wanted to be on television. That was my passion. And I majored in radio and television production at University of Florida. And then my father came to me and he said, this is what I heard. I heard him say, well, I want you to be a lawyer. So then reluctantly, kicking and screaming, I went to law school. And then 10 years into my practice, which was thriving and it was great, I went up to him and I said, you know, Dad, I'm pissed at you. I didn't want to be a lawyer. I want to be on television. He said, Mark, I didn't tell you to be a lawyer. I said, just get your law degree. That would help you in whatever you wanted to do. And I paid for it, so quit bitching about it. He said, if you want to be on television, go effing make it happen. And I looked at him, I go, yeah, I got to stop blaming him. If I want to be on TV, let me go make it happen. And little by little, I just started networking with local people, talent on TV. They hooked me up with news directors and I started doing a lot of local gigs. And then O'Reilly's, you know, people called my firm back in the day and I started doing Fox News appearances. And from that, it blossomed into a career in TV where I got plenty of opportunities to wear makeup to keep me busy.
I told you, I followed you. I certainly know that you were a nightly fixture during the Jody Arias case.
Oh, sure.
And you were working with Dr. Drew. I think that's Dr. Drew, right? That's the...
I would do all those stations, but primarily Dr. Drew is a dear friend. I even filled in for him when he wasn't there a few times. And Casey Anthony before then. And I was talking Michael Jackson's molestation trial. I did all that. So I've done all the high profile trials and I love it because I look at it as an opportunity to help the public understand legal issues in the most entertaining way possible.
When you're doing the media stuff, I think there's a concern that when we defense lawyers take part in doing media appearances, that we're sort of promoting the defense side of things, that we're promoting our practice, sort of like a beating our chest saying, look at me.
Not at all. No, yeah. I've been criticized. I know my friend Mark Garagos criticized me once and said, which side are you on, man? Because I'm not on a side. I was a former prosecutor. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm a father. I'm an author. I'm just a fair guy who calls it like he sees it. So I don't take a side. I'm not a defense lawyer when I appear on TV. I happen to practice defense work, but it doesn't mean that in the last podcast I just did, I didn't trash the Long Island killer, because it looks like, assuming all that evidence is real and credible, that you know, he wasn't framed like the Mona Lisa. He looks guilty.
Let me ask you a question. How did you end up How did you end up with the Scott Peterson case? And when you're, and I know this is not your first high profile, significant case, but do the media, do the jurors know you? Do they comment on you? Do they ask you, can you tell whether they recognize you as someone that they've watched on the nightly or cable news?
There are times where when we're picking a jury here in South Florida, there are people who know who I am. That's kind of cool. There were none who indicated that they knew who I was through the Peterson case. How I got the case is very interesting. Scott called and wanted to meet with me. I candidly wasn't that interested at all. I had already been representing victims from the tragedy. I also believed erroneously what Sheriff Israel, his boss, announced to the world, that we were dealing with a coward. You know, what am I going to do? He insisted to meet with me, and I met with him. I learned, first of all, that he got to me because I did a Fox News appearance years earlier where they had talked about the Peterson case. And I had said, apparently, although I have no recollection of it, I go, I don't know, man. I think there may be more to this. I don't know that this 32-year veteran, knowing kids were being killed, chose to take a position of cover and just cower there and do nothing. I said, I'm not buying into this. I would wait to see more. If he did do that, to hell with him. He should be punished. But I don't know. I think that there's more. So Scott always got a sense that I got him. And then when he met with me, I said, listen, if what you're telling me is true, if half of what you're telling me is true, and it can be proven, you got yourself a lawyer. There's no way I could turn my back on you. And sure enough, I'm reading what he's saying during the shooting. And it's like, Perry, does he know where the shooter is? He's asking in real time where the shooter's located. Everything he told me bore out in the evidence. So I had to be his lawyer, even though it came with a great cost.
Let's set the stage a little bit for the case and your representation of Scott Peterson. So people know, oddly enough, as I was preparing to do the podcast with you and looking forward to it, I was sitting in the corner of a courthouse, and I heard two deputies at the front of the courthouse doing, you know, what I guess is security. It didn't seem very much like security at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm overhearing them, and they're talking about this case. Mm-hmm. They were talking about the verdict. They were talking about this case. So I have to imagine that it's touched a lot of people. I yes. don't know if people know the ins and outs. So could you walk through, first of all, what were the charges? You know, what were the elements that the prosecution had to prove? Right. And when you got into it, because I know that people rely on the media accounts and yes. the press releases from the state. But as you just pointed out, that oftentimes that is just not the case, that the facts are very different. So start with,
yeah,
what's the case about?
Okay, so he was charged with 11 criminal counts. 7 were for child neglect. The government alleged that he was a caregiver to the 3,300 kids at a high school, and that he failed to provide them the care that they were legally entitled by not going in and attempting to determine where the sounds of gunfire were coming from. So that was child neglect, a very unique, novel approach to call him a caregiver. We can get back to that issue. Then he was charged with 3 counts of culpable negligence. And that was because same action, but these were not children. So like one of the students turned 18, so you couldn't get him for child neglect. So 3 counts of culpable negligence, and then 1 count of perjury. They alleged that he lied during an interview. All were just completely bogus. And that's part of the reason why I agreed to do your podcast, because I still have so much inside of me that I have yet to say. I'm telling you, I'm going through a lot personally because of how I was treated during the trial with both hands and feet tied behind my back. It was really brutal. So the more I talk about it, the more I'm getting it off my chest.
Well, you know, I'll be Dr. Neil here for a couple of minutes. Tell me, when the charges occurred, it sounds like the sheriff and some others came out and made press statements, as mm-hmm. they often do, make press statements. And of course, the last line in the press release is always, but of course, you know, people, this is just a charge and people are presumed innocent and the state has to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the last line of any press release. Anybody wants to look at it. the first are always the allegedlies with, you know, the what the state acts like is certain conduct on the part of your client.
But this, Neil, yeah, this is very different. I got to tell you, this was very different than just a press release. This was very unique. Sheriff Scott Israel, and I don't mind saying his name. People say, well, you could be sued. Go right ahead and sue me because truth is the ultimate defense. Sheriff Scott Israel, who was the head of the Broward Sheriff's Office down here, he had a personal relationship with my client. Sheriff Scott Israel used to coach football at the very high school at which my client was a school resource officer. He had my client's personal cell phone number. They had dealt with his own kids who went to that school together. So they were very close. Sheriff Scott Israel, who initially defended my client and all the officers on scene, then took a lot of heat after he appeared on Jake Tapper's CNN town hall meeting. And so instead of calling my client, just saying, hey, can you tell me why you didn't go in? Like, what was up? What were the problems you were facing? He had this famous press conference, no release to the media. He stood in front of the world and said, he should have gone in to kill the killer. It disturbs me. Like, what? So here's what we all believed. And I say we, because I'm a member of the South Florida community, the court of public opinion. And I heard not only just a member of the blue, because you rarely hear cops talking bad about other cops, but right. The head of the blue, a politician, a man that we all respected and admired, he's throwing my client under the bus. So he's saying at the time, essentially, wait, my client knew there was a shooter in that building right there, and my client chose to cower in the corner and let kids die? Move over, Hitler. You got competition. And that could have been further from the truth. That's how this whole thing started off. So the media ran with their villain. I was fighting 5 years of the worst PR ever. I was in a hole. I'm still in a hole. I'm still dealing with it. So it
when
was
you say a hole, do you mean like practice-wise and just trying to get back to normal, trying to get, what do you mean by in a hole?
I'm referring to that the court of public opinion, friends, family, potential jurors, anyone who has an opinion about this case, believed erroneously that my client knew where the shots were coming from, took a position of cover, and didn't choose to go in. There's still plenty of supporters, but I get offended when the supporters come up to me and they say, yeah, hey man, I was with you all the way. I agree. He should have been found not guilty. I mean, he wasn't the best officer, but you can't punish being a coward. I'm like, okay, that is offensive to me. Because anyone who watched the trial saw over 24 witnesses who heard the same shots my client did and could not tell where the shots were coming from due to the pronounced reverberation and echo in that area because of the big concrete buildings. They couldn't tell, and the evidence supported that. So it was Sheriff Israel who threw him under the bus that still stains his legacy and his reputation.
To this day, there are still people who believe, I don't even think that the general public believes that your client took a position of cover. I think that they believe that he was cowardly,
sure,
and was cowering like behind a wall, like biting his nails, sweating like out of a cartoon, hoping that, you know, it would all just kind of, he'd wake up and it would all just be better.
It kills me to hear that. And you know what? Like, look, I've been trying cases for 30 years. There are many where we both know that my client's guilty as hell, right? And I'm there to create reasonable doubt. And the law protects the guilty because if they just don't prove it beyond the exclusion of every reasonable doubt, then they walk free. I'm not going to mention any names of any high profile cases, OJ Simpson. I want to just, you know, not mention that. But there are people who we know got off when they were guilty. This is very different. This is a guy I've lost sleep over. He's innocent. The public doesn't know that during the shooting, he sent the assistant principal to the office to go look at surveillance tape to find out where the shooter was located. And that during the time that he took a position of cover, for over 30 minutes, he's relaying all the information that he's getting from the surveillance video to the officers on the scene. The public doesn't know that in real time, he's saying, last time we heard shots was between the 12 and 1300 building. Each one of those buildings is 73 yards long. We're talking about several football fields in terms of an area where those shots could have been, including areas behind him, the parking lot area that was another 100 yards. They couldn't tell. There were over 7 officers from Broward Sheriff's Office who also took positions of cover. They couldn't tell where the shots were coming from. And by the way, my client literally had minutes to act because the shooter was only in there for 6 minutes and 30 seconds. My client was there for 4 minutes and 15 seconds of that 6.5 minutes. So within that time period, he's supposed to figure out where the shots are coming from, go in and kill the killer with his pistol. I don't think so.
So is there theory that if he had taken 5 steps or 15 steps or 20 steps or had run to the building and been in the building, but then actually once he's in the building, had stood there with like talking into his walkie talkie and his, you know, and his microphone with a gun up like this, that he would not be guilty of breaching his caregiver duty and of culpable negligence? Is that their theory? Had he done anything, or are they saying that he had to do certain things all the way up to actually finding and confronting the shooter?
I'm frustrated, Neil, because as we sit here today, we're done with the trial, spent over a month in there. I still don't know exactly what their theory is. So terrible. Now the Peterson rule is, no matter what, even if you're facing potential sniper fire, even if you think there may be gunmen running around with guns, you know, it's easy to hindsight this thing, Monday morning quarterback, because we all know the shots were in the 1200 building. But when you don't know, everything is a possibility. You don't know where the shots are coming from. So you take a position of cover like every damn officer did who showed up on that scene. Every officer we spoke to didn't stand out in the open. They took a position of cover. But then he's supposed to leave that position of cover to just go start searching hundreds and hundreds of yards in one direction or the other direction or east or west. He doesn't know. So I started asking their experts, who saying, yeah, he violated his training. I said, okay, where should he have gone? Well, start somewhere. Really? Okay. So he should just start running a few football fields to the 1300 building. Then when kids are shot in the parking lot to the right of him, he's out of position. He'll get crucified for that too. The point is, he was set up. He was set up for failure. Even cops on the scene said, you know, we're going to get crucified over this. They knew it on the scene. And one other cop who I called to testify, who was there on the scene, who heard the same shots my client did, I said, when did you learn that the shots were coming from inside that 1200 building? He said, at 7 o'clock at night when I was watching coverage on Fox News.
Oh, geez.
Oh, yes. None of that gets reported, because that's the narrative that the media wants to advance. So my point is, I should be relaxed. I should take my verdict and run. But I'm sorry. Every time they...
Well, you're personally invested, and you're emotionally and personally invested. And something you said on another show really resonated with me. And that is that when we take on a case, we give a part of our own life. We take time away from our children, from our wives, from our family, from people in our lives who are sick, from friends. We give a piece of ourselves to that client, and you don't get it back. Even when you're victorious, you don't get it back, because that time you don't get to replace, and you lose the anxiety and the stress and the frustration, and you get elation at getting a person out of that jam, and out of, in this case, an innocent person, you know, from being wrongly convicted. But you still leave something, right? I mean, you still leave something in the courtroom.
It's not only that. I'm leaving behind that sheriff, whose name I continue to mention, who threw my client under the bus, who walks scot-free. Nobody's challenging him for what he did. These prosecutors get to crucify a man who dedicated himself to law enforcement, who's an award-winning officer. He won Deputy of the Year just 2 years before this. Okay, for 32 years, he dedicated himself. He did everything he could at the time, and he continues to get criticized. So yes, I can sit back and just take the not guilty and move on, but I have not been able to, personally or professionally, because I owe it to my client, and I owe it to future officers and anyone else in the system who goes through this. There's been not enough pushback to those who chose to crucify my client.
Tell me what the challenges were as you were entering into the trial. For example, you already mentioned, I'm sure there was a public scrutiny, a public, you know, whatever is out there in the public domain. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, you know, the horror that was visited upon the South Florida community and the families, which, yes. How did you deal with all of that as you were getting ready for trial and getting ready to pick a jury?
So first I got the judge to grant my motion to have a questionnaire that addressed some of these issues. I want to know before I just started questioning them out of the cold about their thoughts about the case and maybe even the Nicholas Cruz case. I wanted to know that they had given it some thought. And so they had time to fill out a questionnaire. We had time to analyze it and then come back and ask them thorough questions about whether this is the right fit for you or whether you should handle a marijuana possession down the hallway.
You told them in closing that you made it this far. I think you used the word, I went back to look, you used the word, I challenged you.
Yes.
And whether I challenged you and you made, and you had a really interesting way of presenting it. I want to give you a compliment for that because you actually made it seem like they had won a raffle. Like,
yes.
No, you auditioned and you made it.
But that's how it was. They could have gotten out. We could have caused them to go out. They wanted in. So they made a promise. And I mean, bull by the horns. I looked at them in the eyes. I said things like, okay, let's say you believe my client's not guilty. The fact that there are families of dead children sitting in that courtroom, and a lot of them erroneously believe that my client is guilty of crimes, are you the type of person who will nevertheless lower the burden of proof to help the prosecutors get my client because of your sympathy, which we would all have? It's normal. I would do anything for those families, ladies and gentlemen, the jury. I told them I would do anything, but I wouldn't lower the burden of proof. Are you with me? And I got them to commit and say, yeah, I'm the type of person who, you know, and I said, well, explain why. Why? What in your history allows you the courage and the strength to stand up to prosecutors and or victims' family and say, no, they didn't prove this case. And I challenged them. I did. And they were with me. That's what was
I love that concept because do you like voir dire? So many lawyers are afraid of it. I happen to love voir dire.
It's the best thing that I do. It is. It's the best because I don't BS. I look them in the eyes and I say, really? You told the judge you can presume or believe my client is innocent? You ever driven by the scene of a crime and seen someone in handcuffs? Raise your hand if you have. Who else has seen cops? You see someone being arrested. Let me guess. You say, why are they arresting that innocent person? Mm-hmm. And I watch them laugh.
You ever drive by and go like, oh, I wonder what that guy is presumed innocent of. Right.
Right. I mean, of course. And then they laugh. I say, so you understand my client has been here for 4 years. The judge didn't wave his magic gavel and make this case disappear. So you must think he did something. You must. And then I challenge them and I encourage them. Right. Ms. Cohen says he must have done something. Great. Who else agrees with Ms. Cohen? And I'm getting everybody to think it's safe to go ahead and tell me it's okay. You can hold it against them. Yeah. Okay, great. Get out of here. You know, and those who say, no, I don't really. Why do you think?
How many peremptories did you guys did you get? Or were all those jurors, were they bounced for cause?
We got rid of a lot for cause.
Good.
Especially those who couldn't sit for what we thought would be 2 months of a trial.
You know, that's the sign, in my opinion, that's the sign of someone that's very comfortable.
Yes.
With having a conversation in voir dire is if you can get the jurors to open up and you can get them to be excused for cause. And when you can get the judge to recognize it's going to be easier to deal with Iglarus if I just grant these for cause challenges.
Yeah.
And the judge trying to save, you know how judges do it. They try to corner the prospective juror with a bunch of leading, you know what I mean?
He was great. Listen, of my many challenges that I had with this judge, that wasn't one of them. He did voir dire perfectly. When in doubt, he just got rid of the jurors. We got plenty more coming in. He thought the process would take weeks. It didn't. It was a very short period of time. We got what we needed. And I praise him for that. He gave me time. I have little time left on this earth. We all do. So the fact that he can shorten jury selection like that and move it along and be proficient, he was great.
I don't want to get into the attorney-client, you know, conversations, but in a case like this, I think many jurors go into the trial with the perception or misperception that your client is going to take the stand and testify and explain what happened.
Okay.
Did you address that in voir dire?
100%. Because I can tell you that my client 100% wanted to testify. It was never even a doubt in his mind that he was going to take the witness stand. In fact, he fought me throughout the trial. And I just said, just again, watch how this case continues to move to our favor. And that should diminish your need to have to testify. So two things. One, I knew that they wouldn't, once they rested their case, have been able to say, we really proved our case. So there was no need for the defendant to testify. And number two, I got so much of what he said out through witnesses for the state that there was no need for him to have to take the witness stand.
And quite I thought you turned so many of those witnesses into your witnesses. You could almost keep track of like, yeah, I didn't call him as many witnesses because you essentially made their witnesses your case.
Because I had truth on my side. It wasn't difficult. Anyone who blamed my client said he didn't do what he was trained. I'd be like, well, wait a second. What day did you have a training that remotely mirrored this insanely unique scenario? When did you ever have a training where the possibility of where the shooter could be would be hundreds and hundreds of yards in any direction? No, you always knew where the shooter was in your little trainings. You had him right at the end of the hallway and they just didn't know which room he might be in. And you just went into a couple rooms and found him and confronted him. Don't you tell me your training had anything to do with what my client went through that day.
So how did you, in the end, your client didn't testify, but you know.
Yeah. So I had to cover
that. You had a battle with him probably to keep him off the stand. I mean, he probably has, I'm assuming that he had the mentality, like, I want to get up there and tell.
Yeah. You know, yeah. They're going to hold it against me. Anyone who doesn't testify, they're going to hold it, right? So I had to do heavy on voir dire. I mean, heavy. I said, folks, okay, if my client doesn't testify, other than being guilty, what reasons could you come up with that he wouldn't testify? If you say you're not going to hold it against him, what? And I made them, and I got them to talk about how good. Someone could be extremely nervous, how the prosecutors could make someone look guilty, and or they didn't prove their case. And the attorney could turn to the defendant and say, you don't have to testify. I already had all that out in jury selection. They knew there were safe places for us to go and them to come with us. That didn't mean that my client was guilty. And even in closing, I said, you know, I essentially said he followed my advice. He didn't need to testify.
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
Judge didn't give me enough time in closing.
No, I know. I want to talk to you about that. There's so much to talk to you about because
yeah.
So your opening statement, I could tell you were living with this case because you came out, you knew the jury. Let me tell you why I think I feel like you had a lot of comfort watching your opening with the jury. Because by the time you opened, you came out, I don't want to say guns blazing, but you came out arguing.
Yeah.
I mean, you came out and said, he's a scapegoat. You're getting that out no matter what. That was coming out of your mouth before anybody could even turn to try to object or give you a funny face.
Yeah. To the young lawyers watching, this is not for you, what I did. First of all, I don't call it an opening statement. I call it an opening argument. And I generally do argue my openings. And when they object, not if, but when, I just throw in the evidence will show that he was thrown under the bus, that he, you know.
So right.
I need to do it. I need to. I also cover in jury selection. Folks, there may be times where me and the judge butt heads, but the judge doesn't favor one side. You know, the prosecutors may be objecting. I'm getting all that out. Do I have your permission to be zealous? If I was representing you or someone from your family, would you want me to be zealous? Would you want me to, you know, X, Y, and Z? I get the permission in advance to be zealous. I know it's coming. So I will say this again, when the judge sustained all those objections in opening, I think they were probably justified. I'm saying all this because I'm teeing it up.
I know. You got a big tee right here with a very long driver. Here we come.
I argued in opening. I deserved the prosecutor objecting as argument. And it was calculated and it was necessary. And I did it because many people felt after my opening, wow, I didn't know that. And wow, you're passionate about it. And wow, if I don't care, then why should they? So I'm coming out guns a-blazing. Could I have probably argued a little less and then had fewer objections? Yes. In retrospect, would I have done it? Maybe. I don't know, but I don't care.
I don't know. Yeah. It was compelling. You staked a position. You staked a very strong position early on. A lot of lawyers get up there in the opening and they're very mealy mouthed. They're very milquetoasty about how they begin, like almost like they're afraid. Again, I'm not saying every case is call the accused a scapegoat, but you came out with a theory and it was clear early on that you believed it. I mean, it was clear to me. I mean, you if you didn't watch the trial at all and you watched your opening, you'd be like, I got to watch some more of this, which is really what you want, right? I mean, you want the jurors to be interested in saying, oh, I want to hear what else he's got to say. I want to hear what the witnesses have to say.
In fairness, let me say this. Yes, to my core, I believed and still believe that he is innocent. I couldn't wait for 3.5+ years to get up there and finally address these jurors. That said, if you look at my other, 150+ trials previously, I still bring a lot of the same passion. I don't know if you could tell the difference. Even clients I know are as guilty as hell. I'm up there and I pick a lane, and my lane will be, I'm just as passionate because, all right, maybe he is guilty, but the evidence is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Maybe he's guilty. Probably he's guilty. So I'm defending the system. And I feel just as passionately about defending the system as I do about defending Scott Peterson, an innocent man. So my passion is arguably just as strong, I would like to think.
Don't you get comfort by the, this is facetious, I'm teeing it up for you here, but don't you take comfort when the judge says, boy, Iglars, that directed verdict motion, that was a really close call. Doesn't that give you comfort when they say that but rule against you?
Yeah, as much comfort as, in high school, when I finally got a certain girl to look at me and she's like, I may be interested in you. You think you might be available Saturday night? I'm like, yeah. And then she goes, yeah, no, never mind. He had us believing that he was going to end it. But you know what? If I can quote Garth Brooks, who's somehow coming to mind, thank God for unanswered prayers. I'm glad that the judge didn't throw it out. It would have been like, oh, a judge does it on a technicality, giving all the opposing folks an opportunity to say, oh, that judge is the problem. Why didn't he let a jury handle it? Or even those 20 hours of deliberation, which drove us nuts, now served a valuable purpose. We could say the jurors took their time. They evaluated the evidence clearly and consistently and thoroughly, and they made the right verdict.
I don't like when judges say during a preliminary examination or directed verdict motion, and they're like, this is a really close call, but I'm gonna rule against the defense. I'm like, look, do me a favor. Just if you're gonna rule my way, if you're gonna do it, do it. If you're not gonna do it, Don't give us any like false hope. Don't have us sit there and think like you just had us on the edge of our seat teasing us. I don't like that.
That's on you. Expectations are future resentments. if you try cases, not to expect any judge to get rid of it that way, right?
Yes. And you know what? I've come to learn over the years to expect no help from the bench, to expect none, zero. All right. Tell me about you. So much of your cross-examination was you telling your story with the witnesses. And for the most part, there are only a couple that seemed to attempt to give you some resistance. Those were like the experts who are there to talk about like police procedure and that. But you really were engaging with them. Like you had a diagram. You really walk them through your theory. And I want to ask you, when did you know that this caregiver theory was going to be, was going to get to the jury when you were doing your cross? Did you know that was going to go to the jury?
Or you mean as opposed to what, the judge shit canning it?
Yes. Because the caregiver theory is so bizarre that your client is somehow the caregiver for 3,300 people at the same time.
This judge denied our motion to dismiss those charges, which legally I think he should have granted, because I think in the statute it actually says excluding law enforcement officers, but he didn't say that section applies to this section. So he was going to let the jury decide. I didn't think he would then take that away from the jurors. So I always knew that argument would go to the jury, but that wasn't, understand, I wasn't going to make that my primary argument. That's what the prosecution wanted me to do. Say, he's not a caregiver, and make that the number one argument, then what I'm saying is he knew the kids were being killed. He didn't go into the building, but don't hold him responsible because he's not responsible for those kids. He's not a caregiver. That's what they wanted me to do. My caregiver argument was very secondary, very secondary to folks. He didn't know where the shots were coming from. It was impossible. Listen to all these witnesses that we're about to call, and they'll tell you. We couldn't tell. We thought the shots were coming from the football field, which was hundreds of yards away. And that witness was standing 5 feet from my client.
Mark, some of the prosecutors' objections were they kept objecting to you questioning jurors about, they kept saying that you were asking hypotheticals, or you're engaging in speculation, or the questions were speculative. I mean, they seemed like perfectly reasonable and fair questions to me, because the whole case was premised on they believe he should have done something else. And Your theory is that he did what he could. So we have to talk about, had he done X, Y, Z, A, B, C, any combination of, things would have been no better. They would have been no different. He did what he could, the best he could under those circumstances.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you handled this, the objections to speculation and hypothetical. And I mean, how did you deal with that?
It was brutal. And I went back to that courtroom only because a dear friend who I've done some happiness work with, I wrote a book about happiness, so we do some stuff together. She invited me to hear her speak. And I said, sure, I'll come by the courthouse. And then she told me what courtroom it was. Talk about a higher authority wanting me to go back to that courtroom. I couldn't believe all the rooms in that building. That was the one I walked. And I walked in there and I looked up. I looked around the courtroom and then I looked up at where the judge would be sitting. And I started to, I don't want to say cry, but tears started to come down my face. And the truth was, I had been so battered and I had been so held back during this trial with no time to stop and go, wait, what? I can't bring this hypothetical up? Or worse, I can't impeach these witnesses with their prior inconsistent statements?
I didn't get that. I want to talk about that too, but go ahead. Yeah.
But I'm lumping them all together because it's like, I got my eye on the prize. I got to keep going. Acquittal is the only place I'm going. I'm going. But along the way, I'm getting slammed in the ribs and you have no time to stop and go, wait, what was that for? Boom, you're getting hit here. The judge is doing this. Boom, boom. And you're just getting bruised and battered. Maybe it's a little melodramatic, but that's really how I felt that every day. And it's just me. There's no other lawyer where I can go, all right, look, I need to relax after that beating. You take this witness. So I had to just go, all right, who's next? And I just keep going. And I was just getting beaten metaphorically with a law that for 30 years, I've been impeaching witnesses. This was the first time I literally called colleagues. I go, did the law change?
No.
Am I missing something? Is there a new
way to impeach
witnesses?
Mark, I didn't get it. It would be post-traumatic stress for me to go back to that courtroom under those circumstances. And I would still be sitting there trying to think to myself, wait, the impeachment is I ask the witness, this was the question that I put to you.
Yeah.
And this was your answer.
Right.
Right. And that's different from what it is today. I mean, that's the, and the judge said, well, you can't, I heard him say this. You can't repeat the question. I didn't understand it.
I still don't know. I don't know. I teach at the law school. And if my students were to ask me how to impeach, I'd say, I used to know. Apparently, okay.
Walk through the traditional impeachment, how you would typically do it with a prior statement.
Somebody gives a statement. They say, I saw your client and the gun, and he never pulled his gun out. Let's just say that happened. I don't know that happened. And I said, well, do you remember coming in for a statement and you rose your right hand, you swore to tell the truth on such and such a date, which would have been closer to the date of the incident, right? Your memory doesn't get better with age like wine, does it? No, okay, that's all extra shit. But I said, do you remember me asking you the following question? Was my client's gun drawn? And your answer was yes. I never got that to be able to contradict them. He just wouldn't let me. I know.
He said, you could say, I heard that. And he said to you, you could say, the question is not, the question that was asked is not the answer. It's the answer that matters. And you were like, so you can impeach him with no. And I'm like, but no has no context.
If I got one time to ask for a pass and let's move along to another question, we could keep doing it. It would be this one because it's so fact specific to this judge that I don't ever think I'm ever going to figure it out. And it doesn't make sense. And it's really bothering me. It's still to this. I mean, I had so many opportunities to destroy their witnesses and their credibility, and he wouldn't let me do it. And I just had to keep moving on. Just
Mark, on one of the breaks after, you you turned to the prosecutor and you were like, you said to him, not to the female, to the male prosecutor, I think, I don't know his name, but you turned to him and you said something like, I don't know. I mean, now I have no idea how to do it. Like, I don't know. I do I do it? Do I do that? Now I don't know. Like, I have no way to know how to do it, which
it was frustrating. And you're bringing back a lot of, I'm serious. This is why I need to get away with my wife. We have not gone away. We're going at the end of this month. I'm telling you right now, as much as I talk about changing your thoughts to change how you feel, I'm on overdrive right now because it was really, really rough. Winning, yes, that's wonderful. But how you got there, it just was so unfair to me. It was just so unfair. And I'm still bothered.
I will say, you know, kudos to you and to the jury, because
they were great.
This conversation would be a lot more traumatic, Mark, if we were to look at it. God forbid, had the jury convicted your client. We would be looking at this like in a much different context.
I don't know how public this got, but literally before the jurors were about to deliberate, prosecutors came up to me and said, we learned more about juror number three. She apparently was not as candid as you think. During jury selection, she was a victim witness counselor. So I even asked her, I said, I feel comfortable with you, but I got to know, you're a victim witness counselor. Should I put you on this jury? Do I have concerns? She goes, oh no, I was only involved in economic crimes. I had nothing to do with the Cruz case. I had nothing. Turned out she lied, or there was more to it, but she was giving hugs to the victims of... I don't even know all the facts. All I know is it sounded so bad. The prosecutor said, yeah, Mark, she can't remain. We're not objecting to her leaving. And we didn't love her anyway, because she was taking a lot of notes during the prosecution's case. So that was a gift. She, I think, might've been a stealth juror. She got removed. We brought in one of the alternates who we loved, and that helped things too. But she could have hung this jury up, I'm telling you.
Tell me about the... I do, and that was covered. It wasn't covered as much, but it was covered that there was a juror issue. And you were magnanimous about it because you said the prosecutors were, you know, didn't give you really any. They said, "Do you want the juror gone?" And you know, what's your position? And you said you wanted her gone, and they didn't object. So that sort of made it easier, I should say. So I thought you were magnanimous in that way. Something. And I do want to ask you about your cross-examination style, but I have to go over this. There was a point during closing arguments, one where the prosecutor objected to your what beyond a reasonable doubt is not the chart, which, you know, highly likely, maybe, possibly, they objected to the chart for, you know, reasons that I still can't quite figure out. And then the second, because it helps you, that's why they objected to it. And the second is that they were objecting in your closing. And at one point, Mark, you turn, I don't know if you're aware of this, but you turned to the prosecutor and you turned to her and you did this and you mouthed this. You went like really?
You're really going to get a good backstory. You want to know the backstory?
Let me hear. I do.
Great story. I don't think I've told this publicly. Okay. So I joked with her throughout the trial that, you know, that, can I see your knuckles? I went up to her during the trial. Can I see your knuckles? And she's like, what are you talking about? I go, yeah, I just want to see if they're bruised. I go, what are you talking about? Because you've been hitting me in the freaking ribs all trial, you know? And I said, listen, up to this point, some of it is justified. My opening argument, blah, blah, blah. I told her that. I go, but let me just tell you, when it comes time for closing, I said, that's closing argument. I said, that's going to be my moment. Everything is going to be fair and allowed in. I said, I know what it's like to object for sport and to slow the other person down. I did it a little bit earlier on in my career. I said, I don't want you to be that person. She goes, no. I promise. I go, all right, so I won't object during yours. You don't do it in mine, whatever. She totally reneged what I said when she first objected. I went, really? Like, what I wanted to say was, I'm trying not to curse, but what, you know, are you effing kidding me? Mm-hmm. We just had an agreement. That was so innocuous. And what I just said should have been allowed to be said. Really? And it just set the tone. One podcast I did, apparently the people said they counted how many times she objected. It was like 20 something times, like so obnoxious, which then shortened the time that I had to actually litigate, which raised that whole other issue that I can't wait to get to when the judge give me more.
Yeah, let's get to it, because it's because there really because there is an unspoken there's an unspoken but it's spoken rule amongst trial lawyers, which is look, you give your closing, do your closing, just let me do my closing.
Oh, right? No.
I mean,
she didn't. And then, I thanked every prosecutor except her. I wrote, thank you for your professionalism. You know, it's a pleasure to work with you. I didn't. I did give her the oral compliment. I told her, you know, your closing was one of the best I've ever seen. Every time you got up there and did a witness, you did an amazing job. You were thoroughly prepared. I don't take that back. But the way she objected and when she objected was intellectually dishonest and against the agreement we had. And her word means nothing to me.
Let's get to the timing of the closing. Mm-hmm. You were closing, you came out strong, you clearly were prepared, you had your diagram, you had the beyond a reasonable doubt diagram, you know, what it is and what it's not and how high a burden it is and what doesn't qualify, which I love. And then you had all the, you had all the images of the pictures from the trial of all the jurors, which I presume was designed to help the jurors kind of get a visual image again of who you were talking about,
right,
which I think was very smart. And then at the end, there was an issue you wanted to address. You asked for 20 more minutes, which is not unreasonable in a two week long trial. If you had 24 witness, 2 week trial, right? Is that what it was?
It was 3 weeks longer. Trial? I don't remember how long the testimony was, but I think the whole thing was about a month long. I don't know how long the testimony was, but it was, the judge had allocated 2 months. So did we have the extra time? Oh yeah. Did we wait days for the prosecution's witnesses when they weren't available? Yeah. So that's the backdrop. And when he asked Mr. Eigelich, how much time do you need for closing? I said, well, Judge, I don't like having any restrictions because I haven't even written it yet. I don't know how long I'm going to need. There's a lot to cover. And he says, well, I'm not going to give you unlimited time. Okay. He said, how about 2 hours? I said, well, Judge, make it 3 hours, you know? And no. So first, he randomly picked 2 hours without me knowing what they were going to say in their first case, you know, their first argument. So 2 hours was just a random number to begin with. There was nothing scientific about it. Right?
Right.
And so, yeah, so I didn't know how long. I didn't have time to practice my closing. I was busy putting it together on the fly by myself, you know, typing in people's names next to their photographs that I had to cut and paste and you know, screenshot and put on my PowerPoint. I wasn't sleeping. I was literally maybe 2 hours, if I could fall asleep, mm-hmm. 2 hours. The night before my closing, I didn't sleep one bit, not a minute. I was too wired. I was working too much. So I didn't have a minute. And so I finished, so 2 hours, he taps his microphone as he said he would. And I said, wait, that judge, I'm going to need more time. And I asked him, I wanted another like half hour, 40 minutes. I just said, Judge, can I have 20 minutes? No, he wouldn't give me 20 minutes. And then the worst part about it is I didn't get to address all the elements of the charges and be able to go through and just say, I mean, I'm sure I addressed it throughout my 2 hours. I went back and watched it and I go, you know what? Yes, I would have liked the extra 20 minutes, but I think they got the point. But I would have gone through each of the elements. The worst part about it was the prosecutor gets up in his rebuttal and the first thing out of his mouth is, they didn't address the elements of the crime. I guess they're not contesting it. I wanted to jump up at that point and strike everyone in that courtroom, especially the judge and the prosecutor. I just metaphorically, not literally. I was so upset and so hurt that my client's liberty wasn't worth an extra 20 minutes so I can finish it. What would have been the harm? Give them an extra 20 minutes if they need it. What's the harm?
What was your reaction? You asked the judge to make a record and then the judge went through, the prosecutor objected, which I think was poor sport. I mean, I'll say it like it is. I just think, you know what? In a case of that significance, with that novelty of some of the issues, with that emotionality, where you're doing the case yourself, you did the entire case yourself, to not, for the prosecutor to say, hey, look, many prosecutors I know would have just said, hey, judge, if he wants 20 minutes, we want another 20 minutes. Whatever he gets, he needs an extra half an hour, so be it. We should get another half an hour, right? I mean, that's how most, we just want the same treatment.
understand it was her, not the main prosecutor, not the other one with him, she. And I will never forgive her for all of those shenanigans.
Because for someone to say, no, you don't need it. Like, you know, God forbid again, that the jury came back not in your favor, the right. stress from just thinking, hey, I didn't even get a chance to address these things I would have liked to. And then for the judge to, I know that you have a respect for the judge, and I get that, and I understand it, and I don't practice there. I don't know him. I didn't like the one comment. I'm going to say it. I didn't like the comment where he said the standard he has to use is whether he believed that you used your time well. I thought that was an unnecessary, just, you know what I mean? I didn't like that. I thought,
well, I know what you mean. That is the most, one of the most offensive things that he said to me, that the standard is this, I get it. And I don't think that he personally said, I don't think you effectively used your time. Really? Did you just watch the last 2 hours, Judge?
And then he made a comment that you, well, Mr. Eglash, you address things, you address things the jury's not even going to be addressing. I thought, you know, this man is up here. I don't know if you lost weight or gained weight during the trial, but you look like now you look night, you look tan, you look a little more relaxed, a little more maybe in tune with life, but I'm sure much of your personal life was on hold. You gave everything you could to the client during that trial with so much on the line. Innocent people are, when you have someone who you believe is innocent, boy, the stress level is just that much higher, right? Yep. That much higher. Oh. And for the judge to kind of say that just was like a little bit of a dagger. I mean, not a little dagger. I mean, it was just like, come on, give the guy a break. Let him, you know, I mean.
It was the single most offensive thing that he said to me. How dare you? I'm serious. I believe it.
Oh, I believe it.
It's public, and he may see it, and I don't care. I don't get a chance to tell him this, so I'm talking to you about it. And it's not just about me. It's any judge who doesn't give someone an extra 20 minutes under those unique circumstances. That is a miscarriage of justice, period. That's what I'm bothered by. You're asking right. why I get emotional. Because yes, getting my client acquitted, that was the number one goal. But I'm also an ambassador of the criminal justice system. I want things done fairly. I do. I don't mind losing. I've lost before. But keep it fair. Just keep it fair. To not give me 20 minutes, and worse, to say publicly that I wasn't effective or I didn't use my time properly. How dare you? Give me 20 extra minutes. How dare you?
Mark, is there, I do want to talk to you one other thing before I know I've used up so much of your time already, which I'm so grateful for. Tell me your, you have another aspect. I know you have another website, right? That deals with happiness. Tell me about that, please? Would you?
I wrote this book, Be Happy by Choice. Happiness guaranteed your misery back. So if you go to behappybychoice.com, you can get my book. I'm not here to, hell, I've lost more money, you know, with editors and producing the thing. I do it out of love. All of these challenges, I don't say happen to me. They happen for me. So as frustrated as I am with you, I don't regret that they happened. I'm glad they happened. I'm still processing why they happened for me and what the value is. Most of them I put in their proper place. I still will need the time away with my lovely wife in Colorado to process the rest of these things. But I believe that all the pain that we've had in life is there for our growth. And that's what we're here for. And I believe if you could change your thoughts, you change how you feel, and you change how you act or show up. And that's what the book is about. All the challenges I've had in the courtroom and in my personal life, I put into it, I bleed on the page, and I try to help people so they can lead the happiest of lives.
And I hope you're not frustrated with me personally, because I mean, this has been an incredible experience for me, because you're so passionate about—
Neil, you are great.
Your work.
No. It's like being upset with the massage therapist who's pushing right in that area. It needs to be pushed. You pushed and you hit. I'm serious. We didn't talk about this in advance. You literally hit the things that bother me the most. If you said, Mark, is there anything that bothered you? Honestly, I'd be hard pressed to find something you didn't come up with. And you asked it from a veteran trial lawyer's perspective.
I appreciate that.
You get it. And I'm very glad. I almost said no to you initially. I'm swamped. But you know what? I'm glad I did it for all the reasons.
I'm glad you did it too. Really, yeah. You put your heart and soul into that case. It was evident to those of us that watched. I don't know. So just an anecdote. I don't know if you went back and you watched the trial. If you go back and look, you will see, Mark, you are, and this is sort of speaking a circle of the point, you are a, I mean, clearly capable of tremendous performance. You've got your gift with analogies and metaphors and clear speech and imagery is wonderful. You created wonderful images. I want jurors to understand, if you went back and just watch the beginning of the trial and look at Mark throughout the trial, you give a rare inside baseball look at what we trial lawyers go through day in and day out in a long trial. You don't see it in a one-day trial, but in a long trial like that, you see it. And you'll see in the beginning, I watched and you looked throughout the trial, like I could see that, not that I could tell you weren't getting sleep, but I know that you weren't getting sleep. I know that you were living on the edge of your seat. People don't know, they think you're going out to lunch and wining and dining. You had a plastic dish that you broke out during a break with a fork and were eating something in the middle of the trial, because that's probably all you could stomach to do, was to eat something that you brought to the courtroom with you, because you don't want to leave your stuff. You don't want to leave your post, right? Not going to go out to lunch and sit there and have like a 2-hour lunch at a restaurant. You're like, you're scarfing something down.
It was rough. Your digestive system, your sleep, your relationships. I mean, again, I did all the things in my book, my meditation and my gratitude. I needed to do that even more. And I did. So I wasn't insane, but I could see how anyone would just be taken down to Chinatown with that experience.
All right, Mark, I've taken up enough of your time. You deserve, whenever you're leaving for your vacation, you should get to go on it and enjoy your time and, you know, turn your phone off, and you've earned it. I have to ask, what's next for your client? How does he begin to attempt? I got a lot of qualifiers there. How does he begin to attempt to try? That's three qualifiers, to piece his life and reputation back. That's one question. And the second question is, how do people reach you if they want to compliment you, talk to you, find if they want to talk to you? I think it's something like talk to Mark. Is that it? Speak to mark.com.
Yeah, speak, speaktomark.com. Yes.
Speaktomark.com. Yeah. You can reach the man himself. Speaktomark.com.
I will answer you. I handle all that. It comes right to me. I will answer any questions or anything you need. I love to be of service.
And you'll take cases outside of Florida. Will you take a case outside of Florida?
Yes, but it's got to be the right one. I handled that in Texas. They said, first, we're going to put you in jail for life for defending him, and then we'll go after him for the death penalty. So it's rough. Scott's struggling to put this behind him. Obviously, he's 90% free, he says, you know, but he's still being sued civilly. They're going to recreate the shooting in the building now to try to prove that my client heard the shots. Like, it's crazy. They will not stop. So this doesn't end. He's still being challenged civilly. He wants me to be a part of that. I just want to go on vacation right now, but I don't want him be even having that on paper, that he owes anyone money for anything when he shouldn't. He did nothing wrong.
Hmm. That's such, you know, when people see the stories about the not guilty or the acquittal, they don't realize how hard it is for you to get over the post-traumatic stress. There is a post-traumatic stress that comes from a trial and being charged, and there's a post-traumatic
stress. I've never had it like this. Mm. Nothing remotely like it. I've had a couple punches in the chest. I've never felt it like this, ever. It's not even comparable. It was unfortunate. Again, I still feel, just so we're clear, for all the parents who lost their kids, they somehow still, in spite of the evidence, and I don't know if they saw it or they didn't, they either didn't see it, or if they did, they refused to look at it as a charge rather than a foul, you know, depending on using a basketball metaphor. You know, you look at it a certain way, you can't see it from the other side. And so my heart goes out to them. They lost their children. I feel for them. I want to do anything I can to support and love them, but I'm not willing to back down when I feel like I have an innocent client.
Hmm. Really powerfully said. Mark, this was such a treat for me. And I wish it weren't against the backdrop of such an emotionally charged case. I wish it was just you and I just chatting it up for a half an hour about your trial skills and your approach to cross and your preparation. But this was an important case. This was a very important case. Because as we see, there's a tendency to want to point the finger at people like your client. And that tendency is going to continue, I believe, to increase as we see more and more violence, and people are looking to have someone to blame. And, you know,
as long as there's zealous advocates like you out there fighting for people every day, the prosecutors know that there are limits to what they can get away with.
Yeah, so I appreciate keep fighting, that. Kudos keep fighting to you. The you fight. Too.
You're a good one.
You
Neil,
too. So. You too. That's Mark Aglarsh. Again, that's such a treat for me to have the chance to speak with him. It's speaktomark.com, SPEAKTOMARK, speaktomark.com. You'll get the man himself. He's earned a vacation. We're going to give him that vacation now.
Thank you.
And I thank you so much for joining me on the Killer Cross-Examination podcast.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you.